Hello, this is Sparks from Radio Facts, and our address is, surprisingly, Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. We'd love to have a letter from you, and if you'd like a reply, which includes a station card and information sheets, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1 to Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. And you will, of course, also get a mention on this programme, and we'll read out some bits of your letter. Here's Suzanne Vega.
Shops and morning streets and the blue and silent sunrise, but night is the cathedral where we recognize the sign. We strangers know each other now as part of a whole design. Oh, me like a baby that will not fall asleep. Curl me up inside you. You're the jester of this courtyard with a smile like a girl's, distracted by the women with the dimples and the curls, by the pretty and the mischievous, by the timid and the blessed, by the blowing skirts of ladies who promise to gather you to their breast. Oh, hold me like a baby. Fall asleep, curl me up inside you, and let me hear you through the heat.
From Spectrum, the quarterly magazine of the Independent Television Commission. Screen tests. From January 1993, commercial broadcasters will be responsible for maintaining high standards of technical quality and reliability under their licence conditions. Tony Sterling explains how the ITC's technical regulation group is preparing for the new regime. The entertainment and information value of a television programme is mainly determined by the subject matter, the production and presentation techniques, and, most importantly, the personal tastes of the viewer. There is a common factor, however, for all types of programme which can influence the viewer's perception of what constitutes a good programme. This is the quality and reliability of the picture and the sound. If a variety programme, for example, has weak colours and a hazy picture and the sound is indistinct, then the entertainment value can be reduced. Likewise, a natural history series which needs to convey information and also to be entertaining depends in part for its success on colourful pictures and sharp detailed pictures with clear dialogue and sound effects. Reliability is also of great importance. A programme which is spoilt by breaks in transmission, significant variations in technical quality and interference will annoy many viewers and cause some to switch over or switch off. When the IBA was in existence, the maintenance of high technical standards in terms of technical quality and reliability was the prime responsibility of the Quality Control Section of Engineering Division. For this purpose, there was a Code of Practice document, and the technical performance of equipment and systems used in television studio centres and outside broadcasts. Compliance with this code of practice was checked by quality control engineers, who every 2 or 3 years visited each of the television companies in order to make technical measurements on selected items of equipment and general observations on engineering practices. This was supported by technical quality monitoring of the transmitted programmes of each television company, conveniently carried out by the IBA's 4 Regional Operation Centres, ROCs, situated in South London, South Wales, the Midlands and Scotland. The ITC has inherited the IBA's responsibility for the maintenance of high technical standards throughout ITV and Channel 4 until the end of 1992. From 1993, licensees for Channels 3, 4 and 5 will be responsible for complying with ITC license conditions on technical quality and reliability. As we move towards the self-regulatory regime, which will be central to the philosophy of complying with these license conditions, the ITC's technical regulation group, itself considerably smaller than the IBA's quality control section, is adapting its working methods accordingly. For this purpose, the ITC has published an interim technical performance code, which applies to ITV and Channel 4, and is in the process of producing a similar code for the post-1992 licensees. These codes include specifications for the television signal, programme production and acquisition and transmission standards. Video and audio systems and equipment such as television cameras, video and audio tape recorders and signal paths are given specific performance figures, together with recommended test procedures. Also included are technical operation guidelines which provide information on topics such as the preferred viewing and listening conditions for the subjective assessment of programme technical quality and recommended sound levels for various types of programmes and commercials. The technical standards section of the performance code is reviewed regularly by a working party of ITC and ITV engineering representatives to take account of changing technology and production techniques. At the moment, the ways in which we seek to ensure compliance with the code fall into 3 categories. A. Periodic objective performance tests on broadcast equipment at television companies' premises and at facilities companies providing services for ITV and Channel 4. B. Tests of new broadcast equipment before it becomes established in the broadcasting market. And C. Subjective assessments of the quality of television transmissions, thereby providing a final check on all those factors which affect quality, such as production techniques, engineering and operational skills, and use of equipment from production to transmission. It also provides the only check by the ITC on acquired material from outside the UK. A combination of an increasingly self-regulatory regime and reduced manpower resources means that there is a need to reconsider these methods. For example, visits to individual companies can be very demanding on ITC staffing requirements and have the disadvantage that TV companies may become dependent on ITC expertise and resources for carrying out performance tests. In the future, licensees will need to have procedures in place to make their own periodic engineering tests to ensure the required quality standards, the results of which will have to be submitted to the ITC as required. Similarly, the ITC may require licensees to submit results of their own assessments of picture and sound quality. However, it is anticipated that there will still be a requirement for occasional engineering testing to be made by ITC staff, particularly on facilities companies, and also when we wish to verify suspect performance figures. It is also considered advantageous to continue to test new broadcast equipment before it becomes widely used in the industry. The technical quality of broadcast programmes, previously monitored at the ROCs, is currently monitored by ITC staff at the regional offices and at Crawley Court. This is in addition to the quality monitoring by the companies of their own outputs. With this arrangement, it is only practicable for the ITC to monitor a small proportion of television programmes each week in each region. Even so, sample monitoring of this kind will give a valid and important indication of technical quality trends. More frequent monitoring of programmes which are of marginal or variable technical quality will enable us to be more vigilant in those areas where there is scope for worthwhile improvements. Subjective quality monitoring, whether at the companies or the ITC regional offices, includes a quality grading procedure using an established grading assessment scale from 1 to 5, established by the CCIR. Each number corresponds to a quality assessment as follows. 5, excellent. The best that the television system is capable of producing, e.g. a live studio programme. 4, good. E.g. a recorded programme which has been copied several times during the editing process, or a good, clean 35mm print film. 3. Fair. For example, an acquired programme, typically from the United States, converted from one national television standard to another. 2. Poor. Such as a very old film or recording. Some news programmes inserts produced in difficult circumstances. And grade 1, bad, such as several very significant impairments, such as might be evident on the very earliest recordings and films, fortunately quite rare. There are also half grades for categories which do not fall easily into any of the above. For example, 3.5 is a typical technical quality grade for film. There are expected minimum grades for each type of programme, but the minimum quality which is normally acceptable is grade 3. On occasions, programmes of high intrinsic interest not meeting grade 3 may be transmitted when they consist of news inserts, similar topical material, or are of sufficient interest or entertainment value, or where it is not practicable to improve further the technical quality. An annex to the ITC Technical Performance Code contains guidance on circumstances in which technical exemption might apply. This is at the discretion of the television company, but details are sent to the ITC on an agreed regular basis. The general quality of television in the UK is highly regarded worldwide. Although commercial pressures in television are now greater than ever, especially in the areas of equipment and resources, high standards of technical quality and reliability can only be maintained by investment in professional quality equipment and skilled engineering and operational staff. The ITC's Technical Performance Code, supported by sample quality monitoring of transmissions and by selective testing of equipment and systems, will help enable these standards to be maintained as we move towards a more self-regulated system. That article from the ITC's journal Spectrum by Tony Sterling, who is head of the Technical Regulation Department at the Independent Television Commission. Years of Radio Jackie. This LP record traces the story from early operations in fields through High Street Studios to the final close down.
Police with tracker dogs and post office detection men raided a pirate radio station in South London yesterday. Radio Jackie, which was said to broadcast for 6 hours every Sunday afternoon, was manned by about 15...
On March the 7th, 1972, Radio Jackie made parliamentary history when a tape of the station was played to a committee of the House of Commons during a debate on the Sound Broadcasting Bill. This tape, the first ever to be played in the House, was used to illustrate how commercial radio could sound if it were legalized in Great Britain.
Radio Jackie.
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 The station that fits snugly into your ear.
Radio Jackie. The sound of Southwest London. Radio Jackie. The sound of Southwest London.
This is Channel 4.
A new crackdown on pirate radio by the Independent Broadcasting Authority. But is the IBA acting in the public interest?
This is Angela Rumbold, Member of Parliament for Mitcham and Morden. As many of you will know who are regular listeners to Radio Jackie, the government has introduced legislation recently which may put Radio Jackie's future at jeopardy.
From the bustle of suburbia to the rolling Surrey Downs.
From houseboats on the River Thames to office blocks in town.
Close enough to really care as Brit should always be. We're Southwest London's favourite station, Radio Jackie.
In the last 16 years, I mean, Radio Jackie's done nothing but good, and the events leading to its closure are monstrous.
These fascinating recordings with a booklet of photographs all about Radio Jackie are yours for £6. For Europe, it's £8. And with airmail to the rest of the world, £10. Order your copy now from Radio Jackie, 120 London Road, Morden, England, SM4 5AT.
It's Sparks from Radio Fax and from The Independent. Electronic Nose Could Snap Smells by Susan Watts, the science reporter. Scientists are close to perfecting electronic noses that could result in cameras that can take photographs of smells. George Dodd, head of the Olfaction Research Group at the University of Warwick, said researchers in Britain led the field. His team published one of the earliest scientific papers on the subject about 10 years ago and is organising the first conference on electronic noses in Iceland next month. Other groups are picking up on Warwick's early work. In this week's issue of Nature, scientists from the University of Linköping in Sweden describe a sophisticated sensor they have developed that can pick up a range of chemicals in the air. Their semiconductor sensor is coated with different metals, each of which is sensitive to a particular chemical. The chemicals stick to the surface, which the scientists then scan with a beam of light. The light generates a current in the sensor, the size of which depends on how much of each chemical has stuck to the sensor's surface. Thus, the scanning beam builds up a two-dimensional fingerprint of the contents of the smell. But Dr. Dodd does not want to restrict himself to two dimensions. If we were building an electronic eye, we would want to create a 2D image. But with smell, we are not constrained. All we want is a numerical representation of, say, the smell of beer or of grass. This could be a point in multidimensional space. He believes the research marks the birth of a technology, which he calls BOI, Body Odor Imaging. Dr. Dodd hopes to use his electronic noses in medical diagnostics, since people's smells can change when they're ill. Several other industries are also interested in developing the project. Electronic olfaction could help brewers to take the guesswork out of producing a good beer, and could be a useful monitoring device for perfume and drug companies that want to check the composition of their products. It could also help out pollutants in the environment. By Susan Watts, science reporter of The Independent. And this is Queen, Play the Game.
Your heart decide. It's so easy when you know.
my toes.
My love is pumping through my veins.
Play the game.
Driving me insane.
Come, 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 come. Play the game, play the game, play the game, play the game.
If you have ever tuned around the top end of the medium wave band, then here's an item which might be of interest to you. It's from Radio Netherlands Media Network, introduced by Jonathan Marks.
Meanwhile, back to medium wave, and Holland has a reputation, deservedly so, for being densely populated. But in the east of the country, near the German border, the landscape there is very different, with a lot of isolated farms. It seems this area has long been the stronghold of medium wave pirate stations, most of whom played totally distorted, raucous folk music for friends and neighbours. Of course, they are raided from time to time by the authorities, but Julius Hermans in Floten says there's recently been a growth in these stations.
Last Thursday afternoon, I noted 8 stations in the range between 1605 and 6020 kilohertz, and I even noted stations on 1400 and 1588 kilohertz. Most of these stations broadcast as well on Sunday mornings at about 0100 UTC, and then they mostly announce addresses in English, etc. And I think the average power of these stations ranges between about 500 watts up to 1.5 kilowatt.
Indeed it does. The PTT usually only raid these stations if they receive complaints from residents or neighbouring authorities in Germany. In the case of Radio Jan Raap a few years back, the station was using a converted maritime transmitter with about 10 kilowatts of output power. It operated from a small village, and the neighbours complained not because of patterns on their television screens, but the fact that their lights were dimming in time to the music being played on the pirate station next door. Next case, please.
Self-oscillating 813s there at the top of medium wave. That item from Radio Netherlands Media Network.
Whales. Now, is this sperm or blue tip?
Shop, he said, hey man, look at all the stuff they got. How'd you make a have out of a have not? Who needs information when you're working underground? Just give me confirmation. We could win £1 million. up on a footbridge, and he teetered on the parapet. He said, can you see the whites of their headlights? Are they coming yet? Who needs information? This high off the ground. Just give me confirmation. We can win a million pounds. Who needs information? When you're living in constant fear. Just
something from Radio Chaos. Now, someone wrote into Chrissy asking her to play something from the album. She didn't have it. However, I hope I can make amends, because I have. And I've been getting, or should say we've been getting our own letters at Sparks, and this is one from Alan Ellis in Baldock in Hertfordshire. Dear Sparks, I was pleased to receive your programme. I'm more of a knob twiddler than a serious DXer. I have only a shortwave transistor radio, but I find searching the shortwave bands a fascinating pastime when I can find the time to be able to do it. Have some more letters in a minute. And of course, Baldock in Hertfordshire is right next door to the DTI monitoring station. I don't think Alan works there. However, maybe he could say hello to some of his friends there, I wonder.
See how
company I work for works in association with Cambridge Consultants, and I found this in their house journal. I'm not quite sure how serious it is, but I'm going to assume it is. Cosmic Windsurfing by Steve Temple, Part 1, The Hype. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, and in 1992 there was going to be a celebratory race in which cosmic windsurfers, alias Solar Sails, were to race for Mars for the Columbus 500 Space Sail Cup. Unfortunately, the organisers of this race have failed to organise it, and so CCL's efforts to design a solar sail has come to naught. Or have they? What is a solar sail? In space, your speed dictates where you are, or at least what orbit you're in. Change speed and you change orbit. Propulsion in space is all about changing speed, acceleration. So there's nothing solid out there to push against. So unlike a car or plane, there's no reaction to the action of propulsion. Rockets deal with this problem by changing their mass. They start with a lot and throw away a high proportion at the highest possible speed. What remains accelerates in the opposite direction. However, the Sun is already throwing out large quantities of photons, and it is theoretically possible to deflect these and thereby get flux in a similar manner to a terrestrial sail. The fact that photons have momentum and consequently exert a pressure has been known since the early days of quantum theory, and from time to time it has been proposed that this source of free thrust might be used to propel a spacecraft. Until recently, no one had been able to propose a practical way of doing this. NASA studied the possible use of sails in the 70s. They wanted to run a mission to rendezvous with Halley's Comet. They considered two designs for solar sails, a heliogyro and a square rigger, which is square, surprisingly, but decided that there was not sufficient time to develop and launch it in time to catch up with Halley. What about the race? The idea of solar sailing, with all its romantic connotations and its intrinsically green appeal, caught on, and several groups of people formed associations aimed at promoting the idea. However, it was an individual called Klaus Heiss who proposed that the Columbus Quincentennial Commission should sponsor a race. The Commission is a United States political institution whose brief is to organise the 1992 celebrations without it costing the taxpayer. In the end, the efforts made by Heiss to secure funding for a race have come to naught. The World Space Foundation, Union pour Propulsion Phonotique, U3P, and the Japanese Institute of Space and Astronautical Science, JISAS, however, are aiming to hold their own race, but to the moon sometime in the future, but without having a launch or sponsorship. What is CCL doing? We have two plans afoot. We put in a bid for one launch in 1995 and are at a preliminary stage in negotiations with the Russians to launch four sails to take part in a race at some unspecified date. The 1995 launch is not competitive. It is a serious proposal for a test of a solar sail, both as a method of propulsion and in order to explore some of the very exciting mission profiles that a sail could achieve. Ultimately, we intend to hire that sail to anybody wishing to use a sail for some such purpose, a spacecraft with L plates. It is not often that people get the chance to actually try out what they want to do in space before the event. Perhaps the most often asked question is, can you tack? Yes, although the term means something slightly different from its terrestrial equivalent. In fact, all the terrestrial sailing terms have their equivalent in space. Remember my comment at the beginning, that propulsion is all about orbital, and therefore speed changes. If I increase my speed, I move further away from the sun, and if I reduce it, I move closer in. So a mission in which a solar sail were to visit the asteroids and then return to Earth with a sample, possibly, it's possible. It simply requires that I should be able to alter the angle of my sail to the sunlight. Actually, the most difficult manoeuvre is to escape from Earth. The sail would be launched to a high Earth orbit, perhaps 10,000 kilometres, and would then have to carry out a complicated process of acceleration away from Earth. Whilst orbiting the Earth, its speed and direction relative to the sun would be constantly changing, so the pointing of the sail would have to be continually altered so as to produce a thrust in the appropriate direction. It's this manoeuvre that gave rise to the term cosmic windsurfing. But apart from prolonged explorations of the asteroids or other planets, there are some other interesting possibilities. Because the thrust from the sunlight is constantly available, it can be used to balance a gravitational force. Around the Sun, this would make it possible to fly in halo orbits, where the plane of the orbit is off to one side, unlike a ballistic orbit whose orbital plane must contain the Sun itself at the focus. Around the Earth, halo orbits are of potentially great interest. One such orbit would allow the sail to hover over the North or South Pole, keeping these regions under constant observation. This is not possible with a conventional craft. But the most exciting long-term possibility is to make a sunshade. A sail can orbit between the Earth and the Sun, but maintaining the same relative position to both. So a large enough sail could be used to shade the Earth and reverse the greenhouse effect. I estimate that if the world's major defence industries were to combine to do this, we would have sufficient resources to put up a solar sail during the first half of the next century to shade the Earth. I should say that you wouldn't be able to see the shade, it would merely occlude a small proportion of the sunlight. Furthermore, it could be moved slightly relative to the Earth's orbit so that the total flux could be regulated. So we don't intend to let our ideas for a solar sail die. There is a lot of international interest based upon the possibilities outlined above, and I believe that we will be able to find additional sponsorship once we have a definite offer of a launch. The engineering. Well, what's the problem? There are four, actually. A solar sail has to be very large, very lightweight, steerable mirror. To give some idea of the size and weight, Nina, named after one of Columbus's ships, was to be 300 metres in diameter and would have weighed 300 kilograms. This would then have had an acceleration of just 2 millimetres per second. Whilst this may not seem a lot, it means that in 1 year it would gain a speed of 60 kilometres a second. Pretty fast, and more than twice that of Voyager. It also compares very well with the Sun's gravitational force, which is just 3 times greater. If you could make these two figures equal, then the sail could hover anywhere in the solar system, a heliostat. A 10-coach train is 300 metres long, so you can imagine how fragile a structure of such a size and weight would be. In space it only has to support a force equivalent to the weight of an apple, but in launch, the vehicle it will weigh 5 times its own weight, or 1,500 kilograms. Assuming it survives this, it must then unfurl, expanding enormously, for the launch vehicle will be no more than 4 metres in diameter, and less in length. Thereafter, it has to be controlled. To achieve the cosmic windsurfing act, it must be possible to tumble it quite quickly, say through 90 degrees in half an hour, and to maintain any required pointing to an accuracy of a few degrees, without the benefit of a terrestrial sail's keel. So the four problems are building it on Earth, packing it into the rocket and later deploying it, controlling it in flight, and getting the highest possible height area to weight ratio. How do we compare? Whilst I am biased, I think that our design managed to attack all of these problems more plausibly and with greater simplicity than any of the others. It also happened to be most efficient in terms of the acceleration. In particular, the close integration of structure and sail makes building and deployment very much more straightforward than for any other design. And only the Canadian design has as powerful a control system. Jerry Johnson discovered that any bending of the sail produces a tumbling moment due to differences in the incident angle of the light, rather like a dihedral in an aircraft. NASA abandoned the square rigger for this reason. His proposal to bend the sail to control it is a nice reversal of this problem, which NASA didn't think of. But it also highlights the difficulty that small control surfaces simply won't be able to overcome the mainsail's inherent tendency to tumble. Whilst the heliogyro designs should be simple to deploy, their control system is horrendous. Not only is the whole thing spinning, but also the very long aspect ratio of the sails means that twisting them will run into difficulties. If a sail twists through 180 degrees, all control is lost. Making a long twist-free ribbon is extremely difficult and also impossible to test. This heliogyro, incidentally, is an eight-pointed thing like an octopus with eight very long ribbon-like structures connected in the centre. Part 3, inventing it. Most of the above is post-event rationalisation, i.e. being wise after the event. The actual process of invention was more haphazard, although some of the principles outlined above were recognised from an early stage. When we started to think about the sail, we rather assumed it would be impossible to fold up a two-dimensional surface into a small enough space, and then deploy it reliably. The basis for this assumption was partly the well-known effect that it is almost impossible to fold a sheet more than 9 times. Furthermore, it was difficult to conceive of a fold that did not require multiple stages of unfolding, leading to severe problems with the supporting structure. Both Gordon Oswald and myself therefore started to think about one-dimensional sails. The heliogyro is one such, although we felt that this was not actually a good approach, not least because of the twisting problem. Gordon considered a true one-dimensional sail consisting of a string of kites, each one of which was to be controlled electrodynamically using a combination of electrostatics and electromagnetism. The idea of aligning sails electromagnetically became a part of our background to further invention. It proved a somewhat ill-thought-out way of saying we could control any given design. The basic idea was to form coils on 3 orthogonal axes and then align the whole assembly to any external magnetic field, the Earth's or the Sun's. I have found before that inventions sometimes lean upon duff ideas. In this case, if you believe that you can control any design, then this saves you from worrying about the problem and makes it possible to take steps which might otherwise be criticised and killed off. Both Gordon and I felt that the kite train had severe dynamic problems, although it solved the basic problems of building, stowage and deployment. I wanted to find other one-dimensional solutions that would have better intrinsic stability. Grass skirts. I turned to the heliogyro idea. In particular, I decided to overcome the twisting blade problem by making the blades out of filaments. I realised a huge number of such filaments all wrapped around a central drum for launch and deployed by the simple method of spinning the drum and letting central forces do the rest. Here the electromagnetic control system came only partially to my aid, because I could supply currents along the fibres. They were going to be carbon fibre, and by using both the spin and the external field, I could get some control moment, but by no means with the required degree of freedom for a spacecraft. In particular, if the spin axis were parallel to the field, then no tumbling force could be generated. This is the case for the Sun's field, which is radially outwards. Gordon pointed out I could not obtain sufficiently thin filaments to make an effective sail, and also there probably still was a dynamic problem. Who could say whether my grass skirt of many millions of filaments would in fact deploy in a regular manner? I decided to replace the filaments with tubes, and inflate the tubes with a low vapour pressure liquid. I know of no space structure that uses an inflatable tube with a permanent pressure inside it, though inflation and subsequently cured glues are being tried out. What about micrometeorites? Wouldn't they puncture the tubes and deflate the structure like the proverbial Cambridge bike? Surprisingly, it is extremely difficult to find out how often a micrometeorite might hit a given object. Indeed, through all this and subsequent phases of the work, it was difficult to get hard facts about the space environment, more than a few hundred kilometres from the Earth. Nick Kerry did some estimates and found that only a few kilograms of liquid would be required to maintain the pressure for several years. I still fancy this as an approach to structural engineering in space. Note that the tube design still preserves the building, packing and deployment simplicity. However, it makes the electromagnetic steering approach more realistic, because it would be possible to make an inflatable armillary sphere. This can still be stowed and unrolled fairly easily, and yet also provides the three turns necessary for a three-dimensional galvanometer. Preliminary calculations of the currents required suggested that relatively rapid movements would be possible, a few minutes in the Earth's field, a few hours in the Sun's. Note also that the core idea was to wrap the tubes around a central hub in the folded state, and to unwrap them by allowing them to inflate, like the party whistle. Eureka! At this point, Gordon worried me again by pointing out that the tubes would not behave like a plane reflector, and that it might not be possible to get a very high efficiency in relation to the mass of the tubes. Criticism is of the essence of invention. It's fine to be bowled over by the week's idea, but if you can't begin to see the problems with it, then you'll never make the next vital step. Which happened on Friday the 1st of September 1989. I was due to go off on holiday, and we were also due to make final decisions about the proposal for the Mars race as soon as I came back. I didn't feel happy that any of them, the then current ideas, were really good enough in a world competition. Suddenly it occurred to me that it ought to be possible to fill the space between the tubes, and that the infill could simply fold along its length and roll up together with the tubes. I made two models within the hour and sat contemplating them for much longer. I left these models with Jerry and Gordon and went off on holiday. When I came back, it was to find that this design was the established front runner. Ray Edgson finally dispatched the inflatable tubes by proposing the use of the collapsible tube masts. Curiously, I was aware of these devices and had not thought of them in this context. This removed last remaining worries about the potential ridicule that would be associated with a flat tire, and provided a space-proven structural element. This element not only provides the stiffness required in space, but also the force required for deployment. We will build in the potential energy for this when we wrap the tubes around the hub during building. We can also test a quite large size model for deployment. Jerry Johnson added the last touch with the idea of bending the structure to control it, itself a completely novel idea in this field. It was not until much later that we discovered that NASA had also worried about the design of a distorted sail, and therefore rejected the square rigger, although I can't say that the heliogyro looks significantly better to me. To add spice to this idea, it again makes use of the collapsible tubes, making them very versatile devices. At the end of all this, we had a design which certainly goes a long way towards solving the four basic problems. It has no active parts outside the central hub, which makes for simple stowage and high launch integrity. It seems to be intrinsically safe for deployment, because this is accomplished in one continuous action, in which no part of the structure can get out of line with any other part. We can build it in a partially furled state, requiring no more than a 10-metre square area. It has the most powerful and simple control system of any of the designs, and it has a high acceleration. It's also extendable. Ray Edgson and I have made estimates of the design of very large sails. We believe that a 25-ton sail, 1 kilometre in diameter, and carrying a useful load of 5 tons, could be launched from Ariane 5 or from a Proton rocket. Sunshades next? That was Cosmic Windsurfing by Steve Temple, the designer, from the House Journal of Cambridge Consultants Limited in Cambridge.